nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
The speaker today for the colloquium. Just to give you a little bit of his background, I mean, been at Purdue for over 50 years, which is hard for me to believe. I'm just approaching 20. He actually came to Purdue in 1956 as a postdoc, and then moved through the ranks of assistant professor, associate professor, and full professor. He did his degree with Raman. He got his PhD with Raman, and so that's obviously a big part of his talk today. Let me just tell you, I'm going to skip many of his awards. I'm going to maybe just hit the most famous ones. He's a fellow of the American Physical Society. He was a Humboldt senior scientist. He received the Raman Centenary Medal, and he also was the Raman Professor at the Indian Academy of Sciences in 1994. He's received the Frank Isaacson Prize of the American Physical Society. He's a Herbert Newby McCoy Award winner of Purdue University, and also the Lark Horowitz Distinguished Professor of Physics, which I think you got in 1996.
Was it? 2002.
Oh, 2002. Okay, 2002. And so obviously, I think most of you know Anant, but I think I'll just say a little bit about his background. He spent his whole career in solid-state physics and optical spectroscopy and semiconductor physics. He wrote, when I was a graduate student at Berkeley, he wrote what we called the Bible. It was, we called it Ram Dass and Rodriguez. It was his reports on progress in physics. It was on shallow defects in semiconductors. And so that was our bedtime reading for about a year when I was a graduate student. He was essential in the diluted magnetic semiconductor works. He's done a lot of optical studies of heterostructures. He has a particular interest in isotopic effects, and just recently has uncovered some really beautiful dynamic defect states in some 2-6 materials. And so today, I think it's more historical. And so I think we're going to hear a lot about Raman and Raman spectroscopy and part of the roles that you've played in that.
Okay, thank you. So. Is it on?
Yeah,
okay. Can you hear me?
No,
because the other microphone is not here. This is for them.
Oh. Okay, I'll look.
But I'll speak loudly. As you of course noticed that I have a jacket which is not standard for me, but I put it on because as a speaker I must show some appreciation of the honor. But also, I didn't overdress so that I can be distinguished from the students. So, with this lighthearted comment, because I use a lot of optics, I would like to proceed with my talk. Firstly, I would like to show you this transparency which you have been looking at, this slide. This is a very remarkable issue of the Philosophical Magazine in 1906. This is a very well-established, more than 100 years old at that time. And there are three consecutive articles in that. One by Lord Rayleigh. Everybody knows his name. He was at that time the president of the Royal Society. He had won the Nobel Prize for Physics just a year before this. For discovering argon by careful measurement of the density of air and knowing all the different constituents, finding a discrepancy with which he could zero in on the existence of this. Absolutely fantastic. But he was a great authority on optics throughout, since all the time, his career. And the third one I would like to first talk about is R.W. Wood. He was a professor of physics at Johns Hopkins as a successor to Rowland of the Rowland grating, himself very famous. For example, here he's talking about fluorescence of sodium vapor And these are such important contributions that he was named, nominated for the Nobel Prize many times. He was not successful. Then the third person was really totally unknown at that time, except to Lord Rayleigh, because he had sent him a letter. And let me just show the next transparency here. Oh, okay, yeah. He had written this letter for, he had some questions about a subtle point in optics, and he had written, and you can see that the more famous you become, the less careful you are about your handwriting. But those who have maintained good handwriting up to their old age, they are not very famous. Okay, so I will then go back to the next one. And that is R.W. Wood, and that's there you have the experimental physics professor in Johns Hopkins, and wrote a magnificent book on optics, which is still readable, with a lot of new ideas of experiments in progress. As the editions changed, the content also changed. Very inspiring. And the next one shows Raman as a teenager. At this time, when he wrote that paper, which I showed you, he was barely 18. And he had not yet got his master's degree. But he was already into research, spending spare time or skipping classes to do research, always maintaining a very outstanding record in all exams and so on, winning prizes in that also. And so there was some sort of an interesting poetic justice in putting these three people together in connection with my talk today, where I'm going to talk about, this is when he retired from the Indian Institute of Science in 1948, when he was just 60 years old. In those days, retirement at 60 was very standard. And the next thing I want to show you here is that I will talk about some aspects of Raman's biographical his career, and then how he came to discover the Raman effect, and what kind of a few examples from quantum physics, contemporary physics in the late 1920s. And then I will bring in the idea that lasers have allowed us to do a lot of is an ideal source for which Raman was, so to speak, was waiting. But all his work was done with a mercury lamp, which was the standard source in those days. So the next one, I want to give you some feeling of our sort of place, the person in terms of some of the history of India and England. For example, in 1857, three major universities were established in India: Bombay, now called Mumbai, and Madras, now called Chennai. No connection in terms of this pronunciation, because it's a different name. And Calcutta, which is often pronounced Kolkata nowadays. In 1858, they took a major administrative change in India. The East India Company surrendered all its administration to Queen Victoria, and there is a famous proclamation that it's now, from then on, a part of the British Empire. 1869 is very important for Indians because the Suez Canal was opened. It was not just one-way traffic for the officers and the military from England to come to India, but also aspiring scholars from India to go to England and be exposed to all the new developments which were taking place. And this started a very important change in the Indian social and political life. Now, in 1885 came the first institution established to dismantle the British Empire, namely the Indian National Congress. And very many famous Indian personalities were members of this. And Raman was born 3 years after that, in 1888. At the age of 11, he was a precocious boy, and he had already entered the college in Madras, in the Presidency College. The professor who noticed him in the classroom said, are you sure you belong? The school is on the other side of the compound. And after being convinced that he really belonged there, He started on his sort of undergraduate and graduate work at that point, up to the master's degree. After he got his master's, it was clear that there were no immediate opportunities as professor. He was too young. And the typical advice elders gave him was that he should go to England and appear for the Indian Civil Service, which had just been opened to Indians that they could also compete. But he had to go and appear for an exam there. The civil surgeon of Madras said, if you go there, you won't come back. It is too cold for you and your health is too fragile. So he changed his tactics at that point, appeared for a competitive exam for this institution of the Indian Civil Service called the Indian Finance Department, was immediately appointed Assistant Accountant General. From 1907 to 1917, he was an officer of this finance department. And he was posted mostly in Calcutta, but also in Rangoon, which is now in Burma, and Nagpur. And all this time, these 10 years, his thirst for doing research could not be stopped. And he would do experiments at home in improvised equipment and published papers. But then something very important happened. And I want to show you that. He made his first major discovery. He was returning from his work in a streetcar, and he saw this very unusual billboard, I mean the board of a building, called the Indian Association for the Cultivation of Science. He immediately got down, went inside, and there was just the person who was taking care of the building at that time. They would have public lectures or something like that, but everything did not fulfill the original idea of the founder of this, whose name is Mahendralal Sarkar. He was a doctor, very wealthy, and he established this. His son was managing it, but he died a very disappointed person that the science, which seemed to be the key in the West, was not meeting the popular response. And so as soon as Raman asked him, can I use it? His son, Mahendralal Sarkar, he simply gave his keys and says, you can come here anytime you like and make good use of it. And that had very dramatic results because... I'm going to show it to you this a little later, but I'll just go back at this point. And so at this point, he, for those 10 years before he became, maybe I should really go back one more, because you can see that after being here for 10 years, he was using quite a bit of that time whenever he was in Calcutta, which was most of the time, he could use this facility. In these two places, he had to improvise at home. But then there was a very very energetic and a person with great foresight in education who was the vice chancellor of the Calcutta University by the name Ashutosh Mukherjee. He spotted Raman as a very active person. He was becoming known in the Calcutta circles, which was a very culturally proactive with a lot of people excited about politics, science, arts, and so on. And Ashutosh Mukherjee spotted him. He had several endowed chairs in the Calcutta University and offered the Palit Research Professorship to Raman. Here is the Palit Research Professorship in 1917. But he asked him, in order that he be exposed to science as it was being practiced elsewhere, to go to Europe by putting him as a delegate to the the conference in Oxford University of all the universities in the British Empire. And that gave him an opportunity to go to Europe, meet people like Rutherford and Braggs and various other people. And he also came to be known among those people at that time. But this comes back to the Suez Canal, because in going to Europe and coming back, he had the opportunity to see the magnificent blue of the deep blue sea that was the Mediterranean, that is the Mediterranean Ocean. And so his interest was aroused. Actually, he had anticipated that he might get into that subject because he had taken with him some very crucial but very elementary equipment, namely polarizers, which were nickel prisms in those days, as well as complementary filters so that if blue goes through, the red blocks it and so forth. And on his way back, he made several crucial experiments which convinced him that what Lord Rayleigh thought, who had completely explained the blue of the sky, he thought that the blue of the ocean, he described it as the much admired blue of the deep ocean, is nothing but a reflection of skylight. And Raman didn't simply agree with that. He made a lot of measurements, showed that it is an intrinsic property, and that is why I want to show you this. It was something like this, but this is actually the Crater Lake in Oregon, and that's the blue of the sky. This is the blue of the deep waters of any large body of water, clean, away from human civilization close by. Here you cannot swim in this crater lake or fish or anything like that. And it's fed with natural springs. So as soon as he came back, he had convinced himself it's an intrinsic property. He decided to check. This was the question he was going to answer. And he wrote, did many further experiments, and he published a paper in the Royal Society Proceedings. And basically, he realized that there is a more general theory for light scattering, which was independently developed by both Smoluchowski and Einstein. It's called Einstein-Smoluchowski theory of light scattering. Their main idea was to explain what happens at the critical opalescence of liquids, where during the phase change, there is so much fluctuation of all thermodynamic properties that there is enormous scattering of light. And so they had developed, in which they showed that basically the fluctuations of density, which are present all the time, but how much that is dependent upon the compressibility. In the case of liquids, it's much smaller than in the case of gases. But there is so much of it, so many molecules, that even the smaller scattering can, and that is why you need, in order to do the experiment, you must control the naval pathways to Europe and back to India. Only then you are able to discover something like this. It appears that way, at least in the way it all happened. So he used the Smoluchowski-Einstein formulae and showed, when he returned to Calcutta, that indeed, it fits in with the known values for many of the parameters, and thereby he was convinced that light scattering from sea and the blue of the sea is not a merely a reflection, and it should be admired, but it should not be misinterpreted. Okay, so after he wrote this article, by the way, this article is very interesting because the only student he found, because it was vacation, was my father, was a kind of a pottering around there without actually having started with him. So he said, come over here, and got him to do many small things. And at the end of the paper, he is thanked there. So he wrote a very comprehensive article, a monograph on molecular diffraction of light, and put all his ideas of what are the different things which are worth studying here, and also what kind of techniques might be used, including thinking about the possibility of frequency change. There is a whole chapter on the quantum theory, quantum phenomena in molecular diffraction of light. And by this time, he had become very famous in India. Lots of people, students from all over India, gathered and converged on the Indian Association for the Cultivation of Science. He also had the university lab under his control by this time. So he could give them problems in different aspects, and a comprehensive program on light scattering was launched by him in 1922. Depolarization of light, that is, even though you expect that light should be completely polarized at transversely scattered light, it was well known that that shows not a complete polarization. That's due to the fact that the scattering molecules like nitrogen and oxygen are obviously anisotropic polarizability-wise. And So all of these were addressed in a variety of experiments, optical birefringence, magnetic anisotropy, and so forth. He also applied those ideas to talk about X-ray scattering, and pair correlation function was already introduced in that connection by Raman. And he later on turned his attention to Tyndall scattering in colloids. And in parallel with the Einstein-Smoluchowski formula, he developed the light scattering for Tyndall scattering, where he connected it with osmotic pressure and the molecular weights of large molecules. Because it's the same way as light scattering allows you to determine the Avogadro's number, here you can determine the molecular weight of large molecules. And this was a problem which he gave to my father. This is scattering of light by liquid surfaces. It's a very beautiful piece of work, even though I say it myself. But it was Raman who said it's a beautiful piece of work. I was not there at that time. And he was hearing about the Compton effect, and he had listened to talks when he came to an extended period he spent in Caltech, as well as he attended a conference in Canada, and these results were being presented there. He had profound doubts about it, and he said he made a very heroic effort to derive a classical derivation of the Compton effect. He got some very beautiful result, but it doesn't really account for the Compton effect. But the idea of the quantum was already in his mind. And then during the light scattering phase, in their program, when they purified all the different liquids, they had to double distill it, triple distill it, often do it under high vacuum to what's called vacuum distillation, so that the impurities will not be carried over into the collection vessel. And then they did the light scattering. They had built in their laboratory is kind of a second room which was completely darkened, and bright sunlight was let in with heliostats. And the students and the professor, they had to condition themselves to the darkness. And they could then see the blue of the scattering from all kinds of liquids and gases and materials. And they often used to refer to it as the black hole of Calcutta, because it was so hot inside that room. Among the students, I think, that was the designation they gave. And so this persistent feeble fluorescence had the following origin. If you use a certain monochromatic light and had a filter which blocks it, the path of the light should be completely dark. They did not find that. They always found some residual impurity, which are residual light, which they called as persistent feeble fluorescence. That means that which would not go away after multiple distillations and so on. But it was always bothered. It was always something which Raman wanted to explore further. And when he heard that Compton got the Nobel Prize in 1927, somehow his competitive spirit was aroused. And he told his student, Krishnan, that what we are seeing must be the optical analog of the Compton effect. And so he stopped all work going on, and all the students focused on this particular property or this particular phenomenon. And this led to a rather dramatic series of events. This was somewhere around the end of 1927, and by the end of February, he had already discovered the Raman effect. Because firstly, they discovered that we didn't have to use the sunlight to do this kind of experiment. You can use a mercury source. And when they examined the mercury source, and initially I'm told he did it with a pocket spectroscope, but his eyes were so well trained to look for signatures that he immediately spotted that there is a additional lines which are appearing in the spectrum of the scattered light. So let me then go to the, this is how, and it led to the, finally to the Nobel Prize, and for his work on light scattering and for the discovery of the effect which bears his name. And this is how he looked then, 42 years old, in 1930. But let me just go back to the lecture he gave there when he received the Nobel Prize. And this is the Raman spectrum of carbon tetrachloride. And I can describe a number of things which he promptly recorded in his papers at that point, that if you have a monochromatic light at 4358 angstroms, this is one of the strong lights of Mercury, record a spectrum, then you see that there are additional lines which are not present. These are lines which are not, this is the only line around there, and these are three lines on either side of it, and those which are at the higher frequency are weaker, shorter wavelengths, than at the higher lower frequencies, because then he said that these are generated by energy exchange with the scattering medium. In this scattering process, which led to this, these are due to the excitations of the quantum of carbon tetrachloride vibration, and that the you can excite into an excited state of vibration, but in this case, where the system has to give energy to the initial quantum, it has already to be excited. So the ratio of this is a function of temperature and exponential h nu over kT. And he was then immediately able to claim that this is a quantum process. Otherwise, this should have been of the same intensity. Secondly, this is a scattering process in which there is an exchange of energy between the scattering medium and the incident light. Then you must have the same shifts, whether you use this monochromatic light or this another one in the violet, which is at 4,046 angstroms. You again see the same lines which you saw here. And he also showed that this is a universal phenomena. It's shown by liquids, gases, and by crystals. And so all of these factors were fundamental aspects of his, which allowed him to claim a fundamental discovery, which is Raman effect. And I just wanted to this repeat some of the things. At the same time, Raman was developing his school. There was a Russian school with Landsberg, Mandelstam, Tam, Gross, and others. Bruon in France, who had proposed the bluon scattering, which is, in a sense, a classical phenomena, because this is due to the elastic modulation of the medium due to the elastic waves, and you get kind of a Bragg reflection and a Doppler shift. And I should also mention here, there are other people I have not listed here, people like Cabans and Rocard there. So the French school was very strong in this. And I already mentioned to you about the colloidal scattering, and this is the discovery. And now, fast forward, Maimon invents the ruby laser in 1960 and profoundly changes all optics, including Raman scattering. And Ali Jawan followed suit very soon with the helium neon laser. And these lasers and other lasers were enabled and were shown to be important in light scattering by Porto at Bell Labs and Stoichev in Canada. So here is the carbon tetrachloride picture taken with the argon laser. And here is the argon laser in the blue, but all shifts are small enough that the color remains essentially blue. And this is the kind of spectrograph Raman used in his very first report of the Raman effect. And now, there is a classical way we can immediately understand this, that if you have a incident light of frequency nu naught falling in a molecule of polarizability alpha naught, then of course in the scattering, the induced dipole moment, alpha naught, E naught, and this modulation, you'll get the same frequency that is really scattering. Now, if we recognize the fact that alpha naught is not a constant, but it's a function of some internal coordinates, let's say vibrations, then, and let's say those vibrations have a frequency nu or other similar frequencies, then you can immediately see that by Taylor expansion, you'll get this particular term added on. And if you take a second Taylor coefficient term in Taylor expansion, you'll get multiples of this, because this is cosine square. Multiplying this will give you the higher frequencies. But here, the Stokes and the anti-Stokes, which are the side bands of light scattered light, will have the same intensity. But completely away from this stream of experimental discoveries I'm mentioning, there was a profound question which was addressed by Kramers. Namely, how does one understand the very ordinary fact that all material media have a refractive index? And the refractive index varies as a function of frequency. So there is a dispersion curve. All our prism spectrometers are based on this particular property of the prism, which was discovered by Newton. So Kramers then, and Heisenberg joined him in that effort, said that the induced dipole moment in the quantum mechanics comes like a two-step process where the material, this is the electric field, and this is the induced dipole moment, and these are the terms we have of interest here, from the ground state to an excited state, from an excited state to some intermediate, not the ground state necessarily. If it goes back to the ground state, then we have the normal dispersion. But here, we can also start from an excited state and repeat this argument, and we'll get the anti-Stokes lines and the Stokes lines here by this process. And what basically they said was, when an electric field falls on a molecule, it connects all the excited states which can be reached by dipole transition. And so this is a second order perturbation theory, and all of this comes out of that. And this is all of you probably learn, if not in 660, at least in 661. So I want to now discuss a couple of discoveries which followed Raman's discovery immediately. And one of the group which embraced this with the greatest enthusiasm was Fermi, who had just established a great reputation by developing the Fermi statistics and various other theoretical contributions. And when he went into this, he was a total experimenter. His whole group dispersed to various centers of spectroscopy to learn Segre, Rossetti. They all went to different places and came back and did magnificent experiments. I'm going to show you the very first one. This was, by the way, I don't know German, but this means by Fermi, right? It was published in Zeitschrift für Physik. And he talked about, let me go to the next one, where I have drawn a figure here. This is carbon dioxide and carbon symmetrically located with respect to the two outlying oxygens. And this is a linear molecule. And this sort of allows me to describe what can be done with Raman scattering. And one can do a simple normal mode calculation or analysis and show, by the way, this has no dipole moment because this is symmetric and one doesn't experimentally find any dipole moment for carbon dioxide. This carbon can remain stationary and the oxygens can move symmetrically around it. This is a totally symmetric mode in which the oxygens come. It's called a breathing mode, where the polarizability of this will breathe in and breathe out the scattered light with the accompanying modes impressed on them. But this can also vibrate with the carbon going down or going inside and the oxygen is coming out. And here clearly the center of mass of the electric charge is also being displaced, and so there is by the vibration, there is a dipole moment is induced with the same frequency. So you can see this in infrared spectroscopy. And this is doubly degenerate because this can also happen with the two oxygens moving this way and the oxygen moving that way, carbon moving that way. So these two are infrared active, but as it turns out, they have the same frequency. This one and the one going up and down. That's what I wanted to say. And this is another infrared mode where what I described just before, carbon moving one way and oxygen. So there are two infrared active modes. This one is doubly degenerate because of the reasons I mentioned. And you take the Raman spectrum, we can see that it can be argued that the Raman active modes do not appear in the infrared, and the infrared active modes do not appear in the Raman. But Fermi and Rossetti, who did these experiments, noticed that the overtone of nu 1 falls exactly on the fundamental of the nu 2 here. And Fermi immediately knew that there will be a resonance interaction. So on the back of an envelope, so to speak, he could then calculate that there would be a perturbation and that these two being equal, they will split into two lines and that each one of them will have a characteristic of both of these. In order for this to happen, the two nu2 must be the same symmetry as nu1. That means it's totally symmetric also. So all these aspects which are done on a daily basis, used on a daily basis by Raman and infrared spectroscopies all these days and all these years appeared for the first time in this paper. The next one was really remarkable because it also made a change of direction for Fermi. And that is Rossetti studied the rotational spectrum of gases. And you can see, and I would like to, in fact, go to the next slide. Let's say that we have a diatomic molecule like this. It could be H, hydrogen, this could be chlorine, or this could be oxygen, this could be oxygen, so it will be O2, or this could be N2 or H2, all of those which are called homonuclear, that means they are the same nucleus. And there is a center of inversion, and even during vibration, you cannot see this. There is no dipole moment developed. But this vibration can be seen very nicely in Raman effect, and it was. And one can also look at these molecules as they rotate and about different axes of their moment of inertia, that you can quantize that in this fashion. This is one of the standard application of quantum mechanics during that period, where Dirac said that even second-class physicists made first-class discoveries because there was a gold field where you could pick a nugget wherever you bend down and pick something. And so here one can show that the energy levels by quantizing the angular momentum will have this particular appearance, and J can have this discrete values here, 0, 1, 2, 3. And this IM is nothing but the moment of inertia. And so one can show that the energy levels will have some constant, which is a rotational constant, J times J plus 1. Now, in order to see this in infrared, this molecule has to have a dipole moment, permanent dipole moment, as in the case of HCl. Because when that rotates with a rotational frequency given by these formulae, that produces an oscillating dipole moment along the fixed axis, so it's all ready to announce its existence by radiating or absorbing frequency at that. So there's a simple explanation why that would happen. And if this produces a large change in polarizability, such a rotation will be Raman active. So I just want to draw this here. They go as J square. So flare J times J plus 1, so they become more and more spaced. And then we can inquire what are the infrared active modes. We can show that delta J has to change by plus or minus 1, but you also need a permanent dipole moment. For Raman, the delta J can change by 0 or plus or minus 2, but the molecule must be anisotropic. If methane rotates, it has a isotropic polarizability, it does not provide that oscillating induced dipole moment. So a lot of interesting information about molecular structure and the mechanisms are emerging by the application of both infrared, but more importantly for Raman, because this completely is excluded infrared for homonuclear like H2, O2 and N2. But precisely those give you magnificent information, beautiful. And this was realized by Fermi and people, his contemporaries, that the total wave function is a product of electronic, vibrational, rotational, and nuclear. What is meant by this is the nuclei have spin. And so if you have a diatomic and you apply a exchange between 1 to 2, and if it is symmetric, you can calculate how many such symmetric exchanges you can make, or antisymmetric. But this also depends upon whether these particles are fermions or bosons. Both these statistics had already been discovered at that time. And it was realized that if it is something which obeys fermions, or they are fermions, then the relative intensities of the alternate lines will be I and I plus 1. In the case of Bose, it will be I plus 1 and over I. So it immediately allows us, or allowed them, to make very important conclusions. This is for nitrogen, nitrogen 14, whose atomic number is 7. So you have to account for 7 more masses. In the pre-neutron period, this had to be fixed by saying that you have 21 protons and 7 electrons. And thereby, one has to claim that nuclei consists of protons and electrons. And there were strong arguments that this cannot possibly be the case. And so, as soon as the neutron appeared, this all fell into place. We didn't have to make that artificial assumption. And the relative intensities in this case will be I plus 1 over 2. And we know the spin of the nitrogen atom nucleus, which is 1, or we can actually deduce it from this. Because the ratios were found to be 1/2 of the alternate lines. So this is one of Rossetti's magnificent, beautiful discovery, all taken with the photographic technique, but using a resonance radiation from mercury at 2537 angstroms, where being a smaller, higher frequency, the scattering power is increased, and so you can see weak phenomena. So new experimental techniques were innovated by Rossetti. It's called the Rossetti technique, obviously, and for correct reason. And let me then go to the next one. This is for oxygen. And here it turned out that the alternate lines were simply missing. You can figure that one out by looking at the Stokes and the anti-Stokes lines, that is frequency enhanced versus frequency decreased. And from that, you can calculate what is the separation and show that indeed there should have been one at these points here, which are totally missing. And that's because oxygen has a zero spin, nuclear spin, and if you put there, the alternate lines will be missing. Or you can work it other way around. Now, during this time, Raman visited the Niels Bohr Institute, and you can see several of the people whom I could recognize. Of course, Niels Bohr, Raman, but this is George Gamow, and I think this is Oscar Klein. Someone may in the audience may recognize this, I don't know. Maybe this might be Kramers, I don't know. So now we fast forward to a modern day, because I already told you that you don't have to do Raman spectroscopy with photographic plates and mercury sources. In fact, my father took a spectrum of a gas for the first time because he was already employed. He got so excited by the announcement of the Raman effect that he took a leave of absence and simply went by train to Calcutta, went to the Indian Association for the Cultivation of Science, and told Raman that, here I am, I want to participate in this. So he told him, we have not yet recorded the spectrum of matter in the gaseous state. Here is a prism and some slits, and I have these very large lenses. Set up a spectrograph and measure its Raman spectrum of ether, for example. Or I don't remember the other one which he did. And he had to give, the reason I'm mentioning this, he had to give an exposure for 1 month. During that time, Raman took a short vacation. It was a very intense period. Nobody grudged him that. He was in Darjeeling. And when my father finished it, his hands were shaking when he was developing the film or the plate. And he saw these new lines appearing there. He told his friend that I'm going to send a telegram to Professor Raman, and he'll be here tomorrow morning knocking on the door. Exactly that scenario repeated in real life. But with this, everything becomes much easier. Nobody has to work for 1 month to get that one plate, one result. Let me just tell you what we do here. This is post Maiman and Ali Jawan. So we have different kinds of lasers, helium neon, argon, krypton, dye lasers, which are tunable. And that light is brought into an experimental environment where you may have a cryostat with a sample or a magnet also along with the incorporated in the cryostat itself. You can apply large stresses and so on. And scattered light is collected and goes through a big maze here. That is, this is the entrance slit. This collimates it. This is the grating here. The dispersed radiation is brought here and there is, it brought into a second spectrometer. And you do all this. Reason is, even dust particles or anything scattered by scattering the laser radiation is so much more intense than the scattered light that very often you cannot go very close to the laser light. It's simply obscured. It's called parasitic radiation. And this is this maze because the parasitic radiation cannot follow this, whereas the monochromatic light brought in here has its legitimate pass through this, so it royally proceeds through and comes out and is detected. So this simply is a important feature of the current day Raman spectroscopy is to use this double monochromators. And let me then go to the next application in condensed matter. And here I have to tell you that one of the first materials to be studied, the solids to be studied, was diamond. And that has a curious history. Raman had come to Bangalore to attend some meeting in the Indian Institute of Science. And his brother was studying in the Presidency College. His name is Ramaswamy. So he came to see his brother at the railway station in Madras. And Ramaswamy asked him, can you suggest something I can do? He was in the last year in the undergraduate. I can do some experiment. And see, Ramaswamy had just got married and in his hand he had a beautiful diamond. So Raman said, why don't you put that diamond to some good use? He took him seriously. The first Raman spectrum of diamond was recorded by Sri Ramaswamy and published in Nature. But now I'm going to do a more complete description of the Raman spectrum of diamond and other materials. So, firstly, we all know that the lattice vibrations of all solids have dispersion curves as a function of the wave vector or the wavelength of the lattice vibration. And you plot it in a certain way, so the Brillouin zones and all that. This is not the time to discuss those sophistications. But the main point is there is an acoustic branch and an optical branch. And we have to satisfy all excitations and scattering processes in a perfect crystal that the incident wave vector excites a internal excitation, in this case phonon. It could be a magnon or many things which we study nowadays. And this green light is redshifted by exchange of energy. And all this process must satisfy the conservation of K vector and conservation of energy. So if you multiply this by H bar, you get the energy conservation by exciting this. Suppose this scattering process conspires with a lattice vibration or something which is already there. So this green will be scattered as blue here with increased energy as shown here and the wave vector conservation shown by this particular vector equation. And these are called the anti-Stokes and these are called the Stokes. And one can also draw a vector diagram like this and a lot of interesting things can be deduced from this simple consideration, including the fact that let us say that this scattered light here is reversed and this excited light comes here and then you get a scattered light in this direction. So this becomes an incident, this becomes a scattered. Then you can immediately see that the whole process looks like anti-Stokes. That means the Stokes and the anti-Stokes are time reversed conjugates. And if you have a magnetic field here, you must also reverse the magnetic field. Otherwise you'll get an interesting kind of result, which I won't go into. It's called Stokes-anti-Stokes mutual exclusion. And in the next one here, I want to sort of describe to you the selection rule for infrared activity. Firstly, this is very straightforward. Photon energy must equal the phonon energy. And you'd make this drawing here, and this is the photon line here. this slope here is the velocity of sound is obtained from this slope here. But for light, this will be c times k or appropriate refractive index taken into account. And that will intersect here. So here both are satisfied. And this is almost close to the zone center here, and which means that for the first order process in infrared, only zone center phonons will play a role. Otherwise, you have to combine in this fashion, and it can also be done. And you get multiple orders also in the spectrum. Same is true for Raman scattering. But in this case, this phonon must have a non-vanishing dipole moment for the same reason why CO2, the infrared active modes, had to have a non-vanishing dipole moment. And so now let's look at this. We need a sample. Of course, I could make an appeal to the King of England or Queen of England, because when I got into this, I was already, Queen Elizabeth was already coronated. And if you look at the pictures, you'll find that she has the scepter in her hand, in which there is this magnificent, fantastic 530 carats of flawless diamond. Of course, it's not something which I can acquire, but I can acquire something which will do well. And so, what can we hope to see in this? We can see the zone center optical phonon, and this is the structure of, these are all carbons, as you know. Diamond is made of carbon, and there is another lattice here, which is displaced from this face-centered cubic lattice by one quarter, and one quarter of this diagonal direction of this cube. And there is a central inversion here. And this another face-centered cubic lattice can be constructed, and they can vibrate against each other. And the wavelength of this vibration is zero, so it is ready for a Raman scattering. It is not ready for infrared absorption because there is a center of inversion here. And so one can, that line which was seen by Ramaswamy was just this vibration here, which took another 3 years before it was figured out that this is the mode. And one of Raman's students by the name Nagendranath, one morning when Raman arrived at work, said, "I know the reason for this." And he explained to him. And apparently the shout of triumph which Raman made was heard all over the Indian Institute. And he immediately elected Nagendranath as a fellow of the Indian Academy of Sciences, and his career was set by that particular insight. And also by another thing in ultrasonics, which Raman and Nagendranath did, it's called the Ramanath theory. Okay, so we'll do that experiment. This was done in our lab by, this particular spectrum was taken by Ralph Vogelgesang. And this is the same line which Ramaswamy saw at 1332 wave numbers. And the difference is, natural diamond has an isotopic composition of 98.9% carbon-12, 1.1% carbon-13. You can't do anything about it. The evolution, the Big Bang and the evolution of elements has mandated this is the way it is going to be. But there are scientists who don't buy that, like Thomas Anthony at General Electric at that time. And he was in charge of the diamond project. So he made carbon-13 diamond by a process called chemical vapor deposition, got enough of that and put it in his high-pressure, high-temperature apparatus, and produced a carbon-13 diamond, which was 99% carbon-13. And when you take the spectrum, naturally, the frequency will shift, because any person in physics 152 will tell you that the frequency is square root of k over m. And so essentially, that's what is happening here, this shift here. And the second order Raman spectrum, which is shown here, where it's twice the frequency roughly, and also the k vector is satisfied by two summed together to zero, showed this for the carbon natural and this for the carbon-13. This was our contribution to this subject. And with this, we could establish quite a number of things about the lattice dynamics of diamond. And the next one, I want to show you the variation of the zone center optical phonon as a function of composition. And by measuring a large number of them and knowing the X, this is for carbon with 99% carbon 13. This is for 1.1. This is just 1% carbon 12, carbon 13. But how did we determine X? This was really a burning question, because that's the technique they used. They burned the diamond, I mean Thomas Anthony, and did mass spectrometry on that, and found and also measured the Raman spectrum very judiciously before it was done, and found all these X values which we got from him. But nowadays you don't have to do that. There is another nuclear technique where the diamond remains untouched and available for further experiments. But we fitted this for now. You don't have to again. You just take the Raman spectrum and find out which X satisfies the what you get. What the omega will give you the X value here. So, I mean, you imagine this was first done by Lavoisier. He took diamond and with his special furnace he had with solar rays focused on that, he collected it and showed that it is really carbon by showing that it becomes. The whole thing becomes milky when passed through some other thing. He knew the chemical reactions and all those. And when he went around asking all his friends, do you want to know whether you're, what you're wearing is real diamond or not? They ran for cover. So now we go to the fact that in infrared, you should not see any first order feature because you don't, in fact, here in this place. But you do see the second order feature. So we have complete delineation of the second order spectra for both the Raman and the infrared. So much for diamond, but now I want to, by this time my taste in research had become very expensive. So I had to move to, diamonds became more expensive. So, but ruby was relatively cheap. So what is ruby? It is, this corundum means Al2O3, where we have the oxygens here on this, and this is aluminum, and this is aluminum here, and there are two units like this. This is a uniaxial crystal. And every so often, the aluminum is replaced by chromium in nature. Ruby has been known forever. Going back to biblical days and mythological stories from India, ruby is always mentioned. But nobody knew what exactly ruby was. It was a number of centuries before it was realized, and very careful work in the 19th century when they did chemistry and mineralogy and so on. It was that corundum is a pure Al2O3. Ruby is every so often aluminum replaced by chromium. And why does it? Here you can see something very interesting. This is ruby as it's found in nature. And it turned out that a Frenchman by the name Vernuil showed that it can be grown very easily, I mean, after a lot of research, into beautiful single crystals. This is what is grown nowadays. It's a real laser quality ruby. And this is when there is no chromium in it. And so these two colors are identical. People pay much more for this than for this because this is cheap. Vernuil was an idealist. He did not patent his invention. And so the author where he mentions this said this was a real case of throwing pearls before swine. And these are my collaborators in this particular experiment because up till now, I did not mention anything about, about an electronic Raman effect. So I want to show this just getting ready to be published what I'm going to show you. It had been figured out that chromium, when it replaces aluminum, you can calculate the energy levels and we can show that there will be a broad band in the blue and a broad band in the green. In the yellow, I'm sorry. These colors don't match the colors shown there. And there are some extremely sharp lines, sharp levels here. And the Ruby laser, which Maimon demonstrated, was based on, he used a powerful flash lamp to take all the electrons from the ground state into one of these broad bands. They decay non-radiatively into these extremely sharp levels. They're sharp because they're metastable, which means that you can produce stimulated emission from here to the ground state as a pulsed laser. You transfer a lot of electrons. They occupy here. There's a population inversion. You have the right kind of configuration with mirrors and everything. You can produce stimulated emission giving sharp lines. And basically, the Ruby laser is the R1 line here. And it's, these are spectroscopy's dream, because in the luminescence of the R1 and R2, you can get sharp lines, you can apply a magnetic field, and you can get the delineation of the spins of the excited states and of the ground states. This is in photoluminescence. And our question was, could we do the, that is, put a magnetic field on so you have this ground state split into several levels as was shown in the luminescence spectrum, and see Raman scattering within this Zeeman multiplet? That will be a doing EPR experiment using Raman scattering. That is why this particular designation here. So what do you expect? We can see from the ground state these kinds of transitions which are allowed for magnetic field parallel to the optic axis, or you can see delta m equal to 2. These are all Raman allowed from jumps level, and you see these larger displacements. And you can see even 3 only if you are perpendicular to the magnetic field, because there is some mixing which goes on and allows this to happen. And you can even populate the Zeeman split level of these 2 here, and you can get a transition between these if you populate this with another laser which keeps this population up here. So, experiment. Now, here was a very fortunate circumstance. We had the right kind of a laser. This was a dye laser, ring dye laser, where we could pump a chemical, organic chemical called DCM. Don't ask me, because the description goes 2 lines, and I'll be using very valuable time telling you about it. But we don't have to. The important thing is, if you pump it with the green light of argon laser, we can get light from the high frequency side coming into this, in this direction. And when you are away from here, but still we can get sufficient proximity with the energy levels of the Ruby ground states. And this is the laser line we used. And you can see immediately there are stokes and anti-stokes here too. And when we plot the shifts as a function of magnetic field, we get a characterization which is absolutely in consonance with all we knew from luminescence and theoretical calculations, G factors and so on. This was very nice. This was a rather interesting way of an irony here. You used a Ruby laser to produce the first laser. Now you're using a laser to investigate things which are unknown about this laser, about this material. So after enjoying that for a short time, we also realized we can move the laser line close to the transitions in where the luminescence occurs. And so in the Kramers-Heisenberg theory, you remember, light goes from the ground state to photon goes to an excited state. That's not actual absorption. It's called virtual transition. It's simply a mixing. But you can view it as a virtual transition. Energy is not extracted or given at that point. Only when the final process is over in the Raman shift, the energy is extracted from the radiation field. So here, when we bring the laser close to this transition, then this is actually a real transition, so we can get a resonance fluorescence here. But this can also trigger this transition here, going from there to here, and the photon has thereby gained from red to blue with this particular the energy of the Raman excitation of the Ruby, EPR. And so we get a large number of lines which, from, compared from the previous one, have undergone enormous intensity increase, several orders of magnitude. This is 10 to the 6. The previous one was something like 3,000 counts per second. But you don't see any Stokes lines here at all, because these conditions are not satisfied, and our scale here is so large that all the signatures here are well suppressed into the smallest division here. Now we can do another kind of experiment where we chose a photon where we went from here to here, which is allowed, and undergone resonance enhancement in the incident light, and also resonance enhancement in the scattered light associated with this Ramani-Pierre transition, delta m equal to 1. And you can again see 6 orders of magnitude increase in this particular one. And no anti-Stokes lines here. So I've come to the stage where I want to go back to Raman instead of talking about one of Raman's students. So, I need this. I want to catch with Raman's life after his Nobel Prize and becoming a very famous person in the Indian social and political and scientific life. And people like Gandhi used to keep in touch with him or visit him because he knew all these people. This was in 1936, Raman speaking to one of close associates of Gandhi, but Gandhi quite aware that the picture is being taken. And this is after the India had become independent, and Nehru was clearly in charge. He was the prime minister, and there was a Congress, the annual meeting of the Congress Party in Bangalore. So he sent word that he would like to visit our institute. I was a student there. The only day available was Sunday. So Raman just said, we all have to be there. So we were quite happy actually to be there, and in various appointed places, looking very busy. And the team, the entire delegation from the Nehru and his close associates came, went around and had a very fine visit. And Raman was very happy after they had left. He was telling us this was a great day. I'm sure we have made a very good impression. And he said at that point that you can all take the rest of the day off, which was a Sunday. And I told this to my students, so very often when we are staying late here, they don't hesitate telling me that I should take the rest of the day off. This picture is when Professor Chandrasekhar from Chicago visited Bangalore. You remember, I had to tell you that Professor Chandrasekhar was Raman's nephew, and 1983 Nobel Prize winner. And this is 1930, and this is a very interesting picture from the point of view of the enormous amount of scientific talent in that family. There are others too who have made a name for themselves. There is a person, another nephew by the name Pancharatnam, who is no more. He discovered the so-called Pancharatnam phase, which is similar to the Berry's phase, but discovered about 30 years earlier. And finally, when he passed away, and here is the postage stamp issued by the postal department, and this is the first day cover stamp, and this is the carbon tetrachloride spectrum, and Raman in his full glory. Thank you.
Because of the late time, maybe time for just one or two questions?
Which one?
You showed for ruby.
Yeah.
EPR
detector. Yeah.
And you work with single crystals, so your lines are very sharp.
Yes.
So what will be the case if you work with disordered system? Do you still absorb something, or it's too broad?
You will see lines too. You will. Mm-hmm. But they will not be, as intense because of the disorder. I mean, the disorder is a... Even in, when you look at the phonons in diamond, you notice that I showed you the isotopic dependence, and the central one was much broader, because that's one, there's 50% carbon-13, 50% carbon-12, and they're randomly distributed. That is a disorder aspect of the line width. You can correlate it with very nicely with the disorder. It goes as x times 1 minus x. So 50-50 is the ideal spot for that. But very similar things happen. The lifetime is shortened, and disorder is certainly an important thing to avoid if you want to see sharp lines. Or disorder itself is of interest to study, then you introduce a known amount of disorder. There are many examples of this. For as a ruby?
No, like on the solid.
They can be used for many purposes, but they will also affect other things like mobility and the lifetime of effects and so on. So whether a silicon or germanium with disorder will be useful as a device is something one has to actually test out.
So one last question. If not, let's thank Nat for a precious talk.
Thank you. Nice.